Okie dokie. I apologise, first of all, for the enormous delay. We had to stop off at a dealer's, actually, in this glorious subject to load some firmware into one of these things to try to handle two recalcitrant projectors. We left there at 6:15, everything working nicely. Here we are at 7:30. That's how long it took to do 17 miles. Now I know why I take the train in, but we wanted to bring some hardware along to show you. I've taken the liberty of very slightly changing the title, because as I was trying to prepare this talk, I realised that for those of you that aren't directly in the space, we probably need to do some background material. So I called it the genesis of a modern audio-video amplifier, and time permitting, I will go through a few of the things that we've been doing in this space for, count them, 14 years. I didn't realise it myself till I went and looked how long we've been trying to make a living here. I need, first of all, to talk briefly about consumer audio-video formats. First of all, the audio side, obvious stuff, mono and stereo. Once we had stereo on television and on VCR tapes and on Laserdisc, we had a first source for what we might call home cinema or home theatre, because provided there was Dolby Pro Logic coding in it, and that went all the way back, I think, to Star Wars 1, or 4 as it now is, a long time ago, then you could get centre and rear information out, and you had the makings of a home cinema. 5.1 discrete channels came along into consumer space in 1995, and I don't know which movie it is without looking it up, but the only way you could play it was off Laserdisc with a suitably equipped modification dongle, if you like, to its SPDIF output to port the Dolby Digital stream. So it was still a pretty specialist format, the early Dolby Digital stuff. And of course it wasn't till DVD came along, in principle a year later, but in reality it took 2 or 3 years to make any penetration, that we started to see DD go mainstream and surround sound 5.1 go mainstream. The original DVD spec didn't allow for DTS. They made the usual kerfuffle, and it was bolted on later. So several people found out their early players wouldn't, of course, port the DTS stream, and lots of annoyance was had. All of those systems allowed you eventually to get up to 6.1 channels, the usual 5 plus a center rear. Sometimes that was matrixed, sometimes that was discrete if it was a DTS particular thing. It was always 48 kilohertz sampling, no more, although the bit depth was 20-ish bits. When we came to the next generation of products, HD, DVD and Blu-ray, slogging it out in the specification stakes for 2 or 3 years, then they thought, well, we've got more space, we probably want to push the audio as well. And there were lessons from DVD audio, and there were lessons from elsewhere, and of course both Dolby and DTS dusted off their engineering hats and started trying to work on some new stuff. So the basic arrangement, whatever the format, was that at best you could get 7.1 discrete channels through the system, and you could accommodate high-resolution audio, certainly at 2496 level, given you had enough data. Meanwhile, of course, this all goes in conjunction with video. This is why these are audio-video products. And this is the briefest of primers. Composite video, which has been around since the 50s, was supported and is supported by all the original analog formats, including Laserdisc. Laserdisc was an analog system. Along came S-video, which separated the Luma and Chroma signals. You could get a better picture, for sure, but it was only on certain VCRs. And there were even high-definition digital tapes a bit later, you may remember, they came and went. DVD video really opened the field. For the first time, we're storing the video in digital format, and you've got a reasonable resolution in pixels available there, a reasonable bit depth, and although it's an interlaced format, it will support progressive 24, 25 frame per second film type stock as well. So you've got potentially a very high quality video system. And the data rates are up there, about 10 megabits per second, as fast as you can go. I'm not going to talk any more about HD DVD because it's no longer with us. Blu-ray is the default high-definition disc format. And that can store MPEG-2 video like before, or with improved codecs, you can get even more on there. And a couple of examples that are adopted are MPEG-4 in various profiles, and Microsoft's, I think it's OBC, I haven't looked the name up recently. Anyway, the point is you can now get to a picture that has five times as many pixels as there were in the SD picture, although the frame rates are basically unchanged. Blu-ray supports 40 megabits per second off the disc, 25 gigs for a single layer disc, and you can get double layer discs. So suddenly we've got a lot of space to play with. So you might say, well, we've lived with DTS and Dolby Digital, and maybe we could do more. Why do we need new codecs? Well, we can talk about the bit budgets, and they're big on those discs, but I believe the broadcast elements also want a family of codecs that can go from the highest to the lowest, and vice versa, reasonably painlessly. So these days you need stuff that will work seamlessly on the internet, on TV broadcast, on the high resolution, possibly high resolution downloads on the internet, a whole bunch of stuff. Not only in video, but in audio. And the marketing boys would say, and as audio people I think we should agree with them, we do need the best audio we can get, and it makes a change from MP3. And seven channels, well, that's what they decided. In fact, the codecs will support twice that, 13.1. No, but in principle it's there. Other things have been bolted into this new generation, apart from more efficient coding at low bit rates, metadata's better. You can run simultaneous streams in certain circumstances, and the Blu-ray people want the main stream of audio and a commentary, and maybe something linking seamlessly at the same time via the internet to a website. So ideally it should port it all in some packaging system. Better down mixing. That's as much as I'm going to go into tonight. I've got a whole lecture on that, but you know. We have four new codecs to handle, two from Dolby and two from DTS. And again, I'm not going to go into any detail about how it's stored on Blu-ray. There's plenty written up. Wikipedia will help if you're not sure. And of course, the websites of the companies themselves. Dolby Digital Plus basically runs on BD up to 1.7 megabits per second. And in fact, BD, for its 5.1 channels, at least front three, I have to think about it now, the front three, I think, retains Dolby Digital as actually its core. So you get the paradox of the main channels coming down a 640 kilobits per second Dolby Digital stream and the extra surround channels coming in at about a megabit per second. but, you know... these are all designed by committee, and there's lots of people fighting over who does what. They also have the option of Dolby True HD, which is an entirely separate stream. It's completely based around DVD-A's Meridian lossless packing. Peter will know about that, and others, I'm sure, and tell you all about it. They have allowed on the disc up to 18 megabits per second. Going some, you don't really need that now, but if you wanted more channels in the future, I suppose you could have it. DTS HD, high resolution audio, approaches it differently, probably both for patents and for other reasons. You retain the DTS core, which those of you may remember, at its higher rate is 1.5 megabits per second, 48 kilohertz. Now, if there's only a couple of channels running at any given time on a movie, that's effectively lossless. Unfortunately, most DVDs pretty soon turned it down to 768 kilobits per second because they wanted more languages on or more other things, and the bit budget gets used differently. But on Blu-ray, you can and would expect to have a 1.5 megabits per second lossy core. And then the extra stuff is extracted and put in around it, so extra channels and so forth can make it run better. And you have data rates available up to 6 in this case. HDR master audio, Pete would have to tell me, it's not superposable, but it should come out exactly the same as in my simplistic book as Dolby's True HD, the MLP stretch, if you like. But for some reason, they've allowed even more bits on it. But again, it's based around the core and everything else being supplemental around that. So they do a kind of neat job in the encoding
of going lossy and then looking at the differences and encoding that as well so that you can get back to lossless. And that way, legacy products can still use the core. So there's a whole bunch of new ways, and they all share in common the 7.1 channels, and they also all share in common, particularly the lossless ones, humongous amounts of horsepower to decode them, particularly at the higher sample rates. And the DSPs we've been using in our audio receivers, basically up to 2 or 3 years ago, just don't cut it. So you've got to have new stuff. Now, I said at the beginning, we've been in, I'm changing subject, this game since 1995 approximately, which meant we were developing it in about 93 or something. So we've been actually making an audio video amp since then, which completely surprised me. We have one in the boot of the car, but I don't think it's going to make an appearance tonight now. We still have a couple if anybody wants to buy one. I found in the cupboard. And that is basically a stereo amplifier with a similar channel in the centre, and I think two rear channels, count the speaker terminals. In fact, there's two for the centre as well, because the speaker terminals came in pairs. But basically, two rear... You get this little stuff in production. Two rear channels, but fed typically a common matrix signal from Dolby ProLogic decoding. It's an all-analog system, including the analog decoding of DPL, apart from the delay line. So it did switch composite video, and it did switch S-video, I noticed. And you could do on-screen displays in those formats. So at its time, it was quite advanced. It was £800, which is rather more in today's money. It's 60 or 70 watts a channel. I put 60, 70 there, but it's about right. Who cares? And the socket count isn't very different from a stereo amplifier. And you'll see that change, I'm afraid, with time. We made a processor version of it. I'm not going to dwell on that, but there was a market then for outboard processors to do Dolby ProLogic and later to do Dolby Digital 5.1. That market has vanished as far as I can see. So as we produced our own new ranges and lower cost range called Alpha Series, we also managed to design in, based on the Zeta 1 knowledge, not the same platform, but we managed to design in something that was more affordable called an AV50. And again, it's a five-channel linear amplifier. We used ICs to do the output stages for this one. The SGS ST types, quite good. Got a remote control, but no on-screen graphics. We did everything on the little LCD display on the front. Actually, we sold quite a lot of those, and it had this magic six-channel input so that those who had bought a Dolby Digital decoder, another box, could bolt it in the back because everybody was changing. And what comes through this whole ecology of audio video is the damn stuff keeps changing. And at the end of the 90s, we needed to come up with a fix because we didn't have anything with Dolby Digital in it. And by now, we were going to lose business. And what we chose to do, and I think it's probably my idea, though it's all lost in the mist of time, and I'm not sure it was a great idea, but it was certainly a good one at the time, is rather than develop a whole Dolby Digital amplifier on its own, with all the risks that that would entail and all the channels in it and everything, we took a stereo platform, called our Alpha 10 amplifier, and we arranged the hierarchy of that amplifier, the architecture, I mean, so that you could insert signals into the preamp stage from an internal module. And we did a couple of these modules. One is imaginatively called Dave, Digital Audio Video Electronics, I think. Can't remember now. And the other is called Mark, Multi-Area Room Controller, which was a resounding dud. Worked very well, but nobody bought it. This one was quite nice. So what you could now do is take a stereo amplifier, you could repurpose it, a quite expensive internal module, which I'll show you in a minute, and you could continue to use the stereo amplifier to drive the left and right channels at the front. And if you wanted to drive the other channels, centre and rears, of course you wanted to do that, then you could use our power amp, which is the same power amps as in the guy above, but with the option of a third one where all the preamp stuff went in the other unit, so that you could get up to five channels and would relatively easily couple it all together. This is what we put inside. It's a low-res photo. I apologise for that. I have no pointer, but the left-hand side of it is the video switching and the routing and the matrixing of signals in and out. The right-hand side is a board. At that time, we bought in from Sample Rate Systems in Finland. Those of you who remember that. which did the Dolby Digital decoding, had good DACs, and we took a very bold step and paid all the extra money, did DTS. Good move. Because a year later you couldn't sell a unit without DTS in it. And that board cost $300. I mean, the Sub-8 Systems board cost us $300. It was an expensive business. We charged £850 for that module and we broke even on it at retail. So the units were all about the same sort of price as well. There's a whole rattle of stuff that it does there, and I pretty much explained it already. If anybody wants these slides afterwards, you can talk to me. But basically, we got a 500-watt power amplifier system, all real watts, if you understand me. We got an OSD working on most everything. We got it to do Dolby and Digital Yes, DTS, good base management, and the sockets went up to 65. The price, people hate the audio and video being out of sync, and you're the only guy that can provide the solution. In fact, at that time, if you could provide the solution, you were ahead of the game. And occasionally on these projects, we look to be ahead of the game if we happen to fall into the right time slot with somebody. And the other card we played there was, I haven't put it on, but we thought at that time THX was important, and at that time it was important, and they were just moving to something called Ultra 2, which is a new high-spec version for the extra channels, and we managed to bolt it in and be more or less first out of the gate with it because it suited our timeline, and that gave us another edge in PR space, in review space, and in the eyes of consumers. We spent a lot of time as well on the DA conversion. We re-clock the SPDIF data stream with a crystal phase lock loop in that system. We tried it without, and we could hear the difference. And however much you may argue whether jitter does or doesn't matter, we could tell every time. So we did it. And we put all this, I'm going to use a rude word, stuff in to make it custom install friendly. The second zone, the 232 control, so that you could run it from a Crestron system. Very important in custom install, which is becoming a big part of the market. And all that support of video, and a line slip there. And we had the almost luxury, the necessity really, to spend about a year field testing it. Not a luxury one often gets. But in this case, we had very few changes to make to the firmware throughout the life of that product. However, it's a lot less complex than the stuff we're trying to do here. But it has been pretty solid. There have been very few firmware changes needed. That's what it looked like. And again, there's one in the boot of the car, but I don't think we're going to have time to open it up tonight. And I've got a socket count. It's up to 84. We're still going up. And I don't have a pointer with me, but all the phono sockets in the middle of the top of the component video switching. There's six channels of pre-out, actually more than that. There's three subwoofer channels. So that'll be in the white block bottom left. There's an analog 7.1 input, because you might have that from an external DVD source or an SACD player or something like that. So we have to cope with all of those things. A bunch of regular stereo stuff, a bunch of S-video and composite video. And actually, that launched in 2004. Again, we sold, including the model I talk about that tweaked it up with HDMI sockets, we sold 2,500 of those. That's a good number. I happen to have occasionally seen the world market for AV preamplifiers. That's a very good number, even over 3 or 4 years. It's not big, despite all the effort and publicity that goes around these humongous all-singing, all-dancing machines. Most people, including the Japanese, don't make very many of them. Of course, that puts the price up, because you've got to get your R&D back, so there's a big challenge. So the trick is to try to use some of this work in receiver space. And that's what we were doing while we were doing this. We were storing up the knowledge to be able to transfer some of that to a receiver design. We had to tweak it in 2006 because of this thing I shall talk about more in a minute called HDMI. And I'll tell you what that really means then. And the only way we could do it on the platforms is we couldn't take strip audio off it. We certainly couldn't put the on-screen graphics you want on it without a huge bunch of chippery. All we could do is make a switch-up. But you know what? For about two-thirds of the people, that was enough. But if you didn't have the feature, you were dead. Dead. So this business continues to be about features as well as benefits, and that is almost computer space, and it does keep you challenged. But we ran that model basically for 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008. We got 4 years out of that in its two iterations, which is pretty good going. And we used a lot of the knowledge to specify into our Chinese partner, because we still didn't have the resource to do it all, what we would want in the next AVR platform. And it looks from the front not wildly different from the previous one, except there's more knobs, or more buttons, I should say, and some more lights. And on the back, believe it or not, there are more sockets, as we keep going up. So this thing, the coloured sockets top right, will switch the component video, three in, one out. And we can write the graphics onto that bus as well, in analog. It's an analog video path. There is a conversion from S-video and composite to component done by a rather nasty 8-bit part. But it does fit for purpose because people want the convenience, even though the set will do it. Even though the TV set will do it. You have to be on top of these features. Don't have that, you've lost a chunk of the business. You don't even get on the wish list for some people. Seven output channels. The power amp they gave us, first draft, I was looking at that stuff by then, we didn't like at all, and I basically redesigned it from ground up. So we're going to use double layer boards, we're going to go double sided, we're going to do this thing properly. And we actually got a very decent power amp out of it in the end, in the same sort of footprint. And we did a lot of work internally, and we ended up designing the video section again. Fairly big chunks of the audio section here and there. Has a tuner, top left, AM, FM. And, you know, it did pretty well. We made them put in the bigger microprocessor, and we used as much, ported as much code as we knew how. And more importantly, I suppose, we actually imported the specifications. And the specification document for the software was about 50 pages long for an AV8. And we were able to port big chunks of that into this. So we were able to reuse it in some sense. We actually had a more powerful audio DSP than in the AV8 because it had come along. We didn't mention that very much. So we could do DTS 2496, which made about one person in 100 complain on the previous one. You know, if you haven't got it, they don't like it. But we were able to do a huge amount. The performance was not as good as the AV8, not really nearly as good, but it was pretty damn good. And I don't think the guys are here tonight, but one or two of you may remember there were a bunch of one of the UK conferences. I was asked to give a talk on what we'd like out of a semiconductor company, and I wrote a piece about 5 years ago, logically 5 or 6 years ago, saying, well, we'd really like an all singing, all dancing 8-channel DAC with ADCs and volume control, and those awfully nice people at Wolfson delivered it to us in the next year. And we used that part in there. It was very good for this class of product. It was extremely good. So we were able to, you know, use those connections and steal a small march on some of our competition. And we kept that platform going for 4 years. We made a strip down, less power, no pre-outs, cut off a few other things. We, conscious of the HDMI thing coming and biting you all the time, and I should point out we knew about it, we were the second company in the world to launch an HDMI DVD player after Pioneer, with 1.1 and DVD audio on it. So we sure knew about it, and we had nothing downstream to pick up that signal. And we knew we wouldn't have for a long time. One of those things. So we sure knew it was coming. And the platform, though it was more powerful than anything we'd had before, it wouldn't support it. You'd have to tear everything up. So in the end, we certainly couldn't strip the audio off. You know, the ports weren't there on the DSPs, you know, all sorts of stuff. So in the end, we decided to be a very simple plain Jane 2-into-1 switcher, which of course you could sync to the relevant video inputs and things, but otherwise that's all it was. And it saved our bacon. because we had it, even though it wasn't really sufficient, it was enough to keep the models alive. We stretched it with a preamp version, another power down. We kept the prices high, making good money on those, because funding the next stuff we knew was going to be horrendous. We didn't know there was going to be a recession as well, and a major turmoil as HD, DVD and Blu-ray sorted themselves out. So it's as well we did that. And we probably sold, of those platforms, 25,000 units, something like that, over a four-year period, which again is very good. We're getting a premium price for it. So, again, well received by the community. Again, concentrating on the sound quality as much as anything else, certainly at the expense of extra features. The base management was good. You know, we'd really tried to think about these things. But we had something we called internally the technology trap, and we had to spring it. And, you know, speaking today after the recession and having actually done it, I don't think in our present situation we stand a hope in hell of doing it again at this time. But we will now start taking you through what we have actually managed to do in the last few years. So here's some of the marketing input. HDMI, hardly defined, mostly intermittent. it now wants full video processing. Now there's one in your television, your nice flat screen TV that does it all, but they want it here too, and there's possibly one in your more expensive DVD player as well. But they still want the whole shebang. I won't take any video format in and give any video format out without any glitches, hiccups, bangs, stop starts or anything else. It's bloody difficult. Well, all these new codecs are coming along. You better decode the lot, not just take linear PCM off a Blu-ray or HD DVD player, because they can decode this stuff if they're powerful enough, if they're premium models. No, you've got to do it all. there are some disadvantages to that. You can't handle the extra streaming of the commentary channel, should you wish to do that, for example. But you've got to do it. Otherwise, you're dead. we need some form of auto setup, and more importantly, actually, some form of room correction, at least to control the low room modes, low frequency room modes. More stuff. We want those 7.1 channels, and they better all be equally powered. I went through it again. Can we drop the power of the back channels to 50, 60 watts? No. and lots of watts, please. But they better not run hot like those from brand X out there, because everybody will get upset if it does and it will be less reliable. And we've had some heat issues in our products. So please make it run on either no quiescent current or no, which doesn't do distortion any good in the power amp. I was doing power amps. Or, you know, keep it cool somehow, but let's have lots of power. And no, we won't go class D. it was not sufficient, not good enough even today. And we need DAB, of course, for the UK market. We need satellite radio for the American market, but only Sirius would talk to us, XM wouldn't. Luckily, they merged, so we didn't have to do both. We need internet radio. Remember Steve Harris doing his nice demos with Denon? Yeah, well, we've got that bit in there. And it's got to stream music from your PCB, from your PC, but have USB for good luck. The usual extra zones. We want a proper user interface, not these clunky old ones like you saw on that last one when Steve Harris did it. We want modern TV class user interfaces. What else do we want? Oh, we don't want to pay a lot for it, because the prices are going down all the time from the Japanese. and we were making our money at £1,200 to £1,500, and we really wanted to bring this thing in no more than £2,000, fat chance. But that was the plan when we first started the project, even before your... Nick, what have I forgotten? Is that a good enough summary? Yeah, okay. Nick, back in the audience there, is the poor sod that had to project lead this and has done a grand job, I have to say. Absolutely fantastic job. I'm going to divert very quickly into remind you of the various forms of transporting digital audio, because that's what it's about. And in fact, our friends in Hollywood would like to have no analog audio for the obvious reason that they think it's harder to copy a digital stream when it's copy protected. So they don't want SPDIF either. but SPDIF, just to remind you, will support basically 1.5 megabits per second, or 3 megabits in its more current forms. Mark will correct me on the exact numbers. It will, of course, it was designed or tweaked to support Dolby Digital and DTS. So it has been a very good all-purpose transport stream, I would say. There is no clock per se. You have to pull it out. So there's lots of fun to be had in cleaning up the jitter and arguing how much it matters. And we think it matters, is all I will say. For several years, there's been firewire interfaces on some of the Japanese products, between typically their DVD players and downstream to their receivers. I'm glad to say they've gone away. We didn't fancy the software stack one bit, but they were encrypted, and that began to appeal to our friends in the production side. So what we got, for better and worse, and mostly for better, I think, is the high-definition multimedia interface. Now, what you need to know about it is it's mostly for video, and it's based on a system used for DVI, digital video interface, for computers, but with consumer-friendly bits, or consumer space-friendly bits, I should say, like a smaller socket, and more video things carried, and it carries audio. Unfortunately, the audio's, there's no clock for the audio on there per se. There is a video clock and a set of instructions down one of the auxiliary pipes that tells you how you might want to reconstruct it, depending on what the video clock's doing. And no specification how you might do that. And that's led to some variable results in everybody's product, I would say, and caused us to scratch our heads. We do have a digitizing solution in here, which works pretty well. It doesn't do everything we want yet. I'm certainly not going to go into what it does and doesn't do, but for the most part, it has delivered for us. But it wasn't easy, was it? No. The tricky bit. The damn thing has this powerful encryption scheme. And what it does is you have keys on every item in the chain, and you typically have a source, which is a player or a set-top box, and a screen, a sink, which is a TV screen. When you build one of these things, you have a repeater, and it has to be a source and a sink, receivers and transmitters, and the whole chain, it's a point-to-point chain, it is a chain, it's not a loop, but the whole chain has to work, and every bit has to talk to every other bit every 2 seconds. I think the security keys are renewed, so you can't pull the plug out and quickly make a copy of this gigabit per second video stream that's coming down, because it's uncompressed video. It's coming down at colossal speed, but they still don't want you to make a copy. So you have all of this stuff going on. And I put the little sad smiley on there because we're piggy in the middle, and even if something else isn't quite right in its implementation, we're the people that's expected to fix it, as we were this evening, I seem to recall, earlier before we came here, with somebody's nameless projector. You also need to know that every 2 years they change the spec. Pretty good. When they started it, it supported high-definition video, and on audio, it supported, well, what it says, 2-channel 48, 24, and DT and DD and DTS. So you've got going with that, but nobody wants that. They wanted to port DVD-A down it, jolly good. They managed to get that all working and packetized correctly and all the right auxiliary signals and so forth on 1.1, which is what we managed to remember to bolt into the first DVD player we did, and the chips have just come out. There's one main vendor of these chips called Silicon Image, who owns a lot of the IP. There are others in the space, but you're frankly often dependent on Silicon Image for the latest stuff, because they have the inside track in generating the spec. They're expensive, they're a bit flaky. Fair? Not bad for what they do, but, you know, there's plenty of wrinkles. 1.2 didn't really do much, because who wants to transport native DSD, with respect to anybody that does? In general, you don't, right? But it was bolted in. CEC is Consumer Electronics Control, and that's like the old AV link that ran on SCART, where you can point the remote at the TV, and it sends a blink and flash and signal back to the upstream boxes and tells them what to do. And there's a version of that on there. All of those things run, by the way, on an I2C bus, which is designed to work between integrated circuits about 6 inches apart. And these guys somehow expect it to work so over the 5 meters which HDMI is defined to work, and probably 50 meters is what some people want to put in. So you have to slow the bus right down because it's capacitively loaded, or it stops. And I think we were the people that found out the test system they used didn't work at some point. You had a long cable, because basically they had to rewrite it. But everybody waited for this magic thing called 1.3. Oh my God. And 1.3 does lots of stuff. faster video, the full Monty 8 channels at full high res as linear PCM, and it is the first thing that will support the new codec streams in native format. Nothing else will. So you are stuffed unless you've got 1.3 on these boxes. And a number of people have made intermediate products that support 1.1 or 1.2 and can handle linear PCM, but it don't cut it in the market, lads. You've got to be up to it. And the first chips were called 1.3A because they actually didn't do some of this stuff. Or was that 1.3 and 1.3A? I can't remember, on 1.3B. But there were various informal notifications amongst consumers, engineers and everybody else while they got the chips to work properly. So, you know, and you're on the bleeding edge of this, trying to make this stuff work, while they're still fighting the silicon and the controlling software. So, exciting times. There's a rule, I think, in ideal development that says only work with silicon and software that's proven. Sadly, this isn't the space to do it in. And now we've got this one coming. And you can, if you sign a very informal NDA and you just put your name in, they'll give you the spec. And it adds primarily it adds Ethernet, so that now you can go onto the web with this stuff. I can't wait to have a web. super high res video format. They've had a stab at supporting what they think might be coming in 3D HD TV, but since nobody quite knows what the standard's going to be, it's only a stab, so it's left a bit undefined at this moment. They've just got development silicon out, I think. Don't think we've seen it. And next year, of course, they say the products will have it. You know, are you dead next year without it? I don't know. I don't think you are, but, you know, they never stop. And how do we tackle that? Do we build the product on one big circuit board? I tell you what, we better not do that if we're going to have to tear bits off it randomly, because you need new chipsets. Yeah, make no mistake. So here's what we did, and it's a very quick summary. We knew we had to do this stuff, and in late 2005, before next time, but I sat down with the engineers, and it's part of my job to spec it at that point, or try to spec, do the market spec, and we started to decide what we couldn't do, along with the chips that we saw were available in the market. We've been playing with video processors and our DVD players. We had some idea of the ones that were around, and actually our view was that the Rialta was very nice, and the software never worked, and it was about five times too expensive. We looked at one from National Semi. I'm glad we didn't use it because they sold it to somebody else a few months later. We looked at one from somebody else and somebody else. And in the end, we did find something. I'll tell you what it is. But that's a huge key part of the subsystem. You can't do the video processing. And by the way, it better be 10-bit at least. Probably these days it should be 12. Now, everything's only on 8-bit 420 video, if you know it. And 420 means it's not as good as it might be. It's not 444 video, but you better have this extra horsepower in, lads, or you're nowhere. We have to do it all, right? Microprocessor, video, audio, all those things you have to do with audio we know and love. Oh, and Ethernet. So we started to choose the key parts, and we talked to the European people, and we, in the end, chose a Pixelworks scaler. Pixelworks make high-end chips for projectors, and they try to make lower-end chips for TVs, but their business tends to be moderately high-end. Most of the SIN projectors, for example, use these parts, and they're highly rated. And we found they had one that would work for us and would double as the system micro. The only bit, and they said, yes, we could do the changes you need. The only bit we didn't realize, they'd never done an AVR before. It's not quite the same as doing a projector. Never mind, that's what we picked, and we started developing. We bought development boards and the annual licenses to run the stuff, which cost money, and started coding. We chose our friends, thanks to Steve Harris, who's not here, at BridgeCo, to do the internet streaming solution. Frankly, there were very few solutions we could have chosen that looked remotely mature and that would do the kind of things we wanted. And again, they agreed to work with us, although frankly we were on the small side. And one of the things a company like Arcam has to do is be to work with the silicon companies is punch above its weight somehow, because we're never going to buy the quantity of chips that their marketing people and salespeople would want. So we will pay more for the chips. We hate it, but we have to do it to give them a return. And we do feedback you know, a surprising number of software issues that you might not have expected still to be there. And we do push them a bit. And that, on the whole, has worked, I think. But my goodness, it's a tricky path. And there are times where it goes, I won't use the normal lab expression, belly up, I will use. this power amplifier, if there's time at the end, I'll talk a bit more about it, but not in the context here. They wanted more power. There wasn't that much space. It had better be a damn good amplifier, because that's what we do. And we were worried about heat. And a colleague of mine at the time had developed a lifter circuit for an IC we used in our solo products to run in class G. And I thought we could probably use that. It was a bit different from the normal application. I thought we could probably use that and some modern amplifier technology to get something rather special as the amplifier. And that was what was given to me as my full-time day job. And I spent something like 2 years on it, which is an appalling amount of time. But we have got something I honestly believe is rather special in the space out of this amplifier. The power is not enormous. The voltage swing is not enormous, but now I have some current on one set of output transistors, you know, and it does the job. I'll explain a bit more if there's time. Nick, lucky boy, joined us in 2006 and was given the plum job of running this team. I think it's fair to say you've had some experience of processors before, so you knew what you were getting into, didn't you?
No.
yeah, quite. No, I'm not sure any of us knew what we were getting into. If we knew what we knew now, would we have done the project? I don't know. It's an internal debate. I think we probably had no choice if we wanted to stay in the game. We were up to 4 software people working full time on this thing. And actually, it took, averaged out 10 people 2 years to eat the bulk of the project, 20 man years. And we're still working on it, of course. And that's when we started, the engineering team started to do the block diagrams, first draft schematics. There's about 15 PCBs in this thing. And very importantly, very good decision, we decided we had to do something modular. Although the back panel is not modular, which leads to all sorts of expectations from one's customer base, that in the past we've not always been able to fulfill as well as we would like, because it's the way life is. Despite that, it is a modular construction, if only for ease of production, servicing, and maintaining a competitive product in the future. And people can come up afterwards. I've got some shots anyway, and show you a little bit of how that's done. And also the way the construction is laid out, to some degree, keeps the really filthy microprocessor stuff away from a lot of the audio. Before we add all the magic dust of RF screening and ferrites and all the other bits and bobs we use in there. And by the end of 2006, we'd laid out most of the circuit boards, we're getting them built. This is the times I was given, so I think we're right here looking them up again. It's so long ago, it seems like only yesterday. I went to CES in the beginning of 2007, as you do, and the Dolby boys invited me along to a special private demo, which turned out to be Dolby Volume. And this, we've had a lecture here on this project, and I think it's quite important. And it does a lot, and a lot more sophisticatedly than some of its competitors, in maintaining very good surround sound at low levels, and separately, a separate process, equalising the level differences between different material, particularly applicable to ordinary TV, where the ads really are disgusting, and the trailers, compared with, say, a film programme or something like that. And basically, I pushed for that to be in the design if our people could, you know, if the DSP maker could handle it, and they thought they could, and if Dolby actually finished the project. So there were some challenges, but it was at least on the wish list, and it was in the plan. And so it affects the OSD and the way we design the software. By the middle of that year, we were up to 5 people, all our software engineers, I think, just about. Everybody flat out on this thing. And then we had, no names, no pack drill, our audio IC maker, another here, with whom we worked for many years on many projects, basically tell us the chip wouldn't do it. It wouldn't do some of the things it was supposed to do. And I think I'm correct in saying I wasn't in those meetings, that we had to tear up the whole work we'd done to program the low-level systems, start again. They were going to redesign the whole thing at the medium level. And would we like to wait, please? And no, we're sorry we didn't tell you about it earlier. And that's pretty dodgy. So we did come up with a plan B, and it's as well we did. And actually, we had to abandon the original solution, and some of our colleagues and competitors are only just coming to market on that solution. And we've been in the market nearly a year now. We had to pay twice as much for the analog devices solution, but it works. And time to market is everything. So I think there's an interesting lesson there. And at the beginning, there's no way we could have seen, or I, with respect, I don't think that the silicon supplier at that time could have seen that it wasn't going to go. You go into these things in good faith, but every so often you hit a big one. And we had problems with all of the three main subsystems in getting them to work. The video, the audio DSPs particularly, and the Ethernet stuff. There were, you know, quite a lot of challenges to get it working the way we wanted there as well, which we have got solved in the video and Ethernet terms. But this one we still would be hanging around, I reckon. So we had to change horses. Now, at least it was modular. So we only had to tear up two PCBs, one PCB. So, you know, and we'd had experience with this solution. Nick had, and others had, from previous life. So we knew we were getting into something that would probably make work. It's actually rather more flexible for the future. So, into 2008 now. Well, the original plan said we were shipping it by now for $2,000. Well, no. It turned out to be a bit challenging. We've got 10 people on this. So, mostly, and I've simplified it by not looking up all the records, we've got something, we've got boards, we've got chassis, we've got stuff that looks like a product, but it isn't shippable. So we spend all that time trying to get it together, basically, so it's fit for production. And we had made the decision at that point, because it was very clear that our 300, 350 series was going to die on its feet, that we would fill the hole in our Chinese partners' production line with this thing. They thought we couldn't do it at all, and they thought the numbers would not be big enough, but actually in both cases to some degree we proved them wrong, I think. But we decided to put it out to the Far East, and by the end of the year we got prototypes at the US trade show at Cedia. We'd started showing it to selected dealers. We're probably beta-ing it by then, weren't we, Nick? Yeah. We started doing all the things you need to. And yes, we turned out, Nick and I went to a thing with Dolby around that time, and it turns out we and one other company were the only people who got Dolby volume anywhere near to market. In fact, the other company is still waiting to ship it, I think.
Shipped last month.
I'm happy to stand corrected. Well, we shipped in January 2009. The other guy shipped in October 2009. So we had a lot of Dolby's attention, which doesn't do us any harm. And this is the bastard. a less normal word than my. I'm not doing my Alan Sugar moments here. There was a marketing decision to make it look different, so we took off all the knobs. And mostly you can run it from the remote. Of course, you can run it from the front panel too. But we wanted something that would stand out. And this is what we got. You can have it in black, you can have it in silver. It's big, and I have to tell you, when you come to lift it, it's about 30-something kilos heavy.
Wow.
It's got a thundering transformer in there, a steel chassis, and it's quite thick to support it all, a huge faceplate, etc., big heatsink, blah, blah, blah. And a rather nice VFD, which is all graphics, so that we can write up the volume control so you can see it across the other side of the room, which is quite important, we've found. There's the back panel. I've got a socket count somewhere, but it's well into the 100. 115, I think, but I can't remember. We'll find it in a minute. And on the left is legacy stuff, component video. Well, we got the space. We put 5 on because we made this thing taller than the other stuff, because otherwise we couldn't fit it all in. And you're actually, on a design, are constrained on the rear panel by the number of sockets you have to have. So it's got all these stuff, and you can imagine the boards are running vertically. So the left two boards are basically, that you can see on here, are basically the video. The next one's the SPDIF. Then that'll be stereo inputs. Then the last set of phono sockets is the multi-channel ins and pre-outs, if you want a bigger power amp. Serial control, an iPod docking thing, if we can do all that too, and show the first couple of lines of the iPod on that front VFD. So we've got the, which we've been doing for other projects, we've integrated all that in as well. So it does cover a lot of bases, three-zone support in audio, two in video, and a humongous number of fairly fat speaker terminals on the right-hand side to do the channels. Gulp. Oh, back one. And along the bottom, HDMI. Five in, two out, full power video processor. The two out are basically in parallel. We haven't gone for the double video processor solution, as though a few people would like that. We'd probably still be coding it. And there'd be even more to go wrong. It's another reason it doesn't have wireless on it, although it has an Ethernet port. We had actually considered putting it in and designed it to go in, and then we thought of the support calls about Wavell's wireless networks, and we took it out again. Go buy a bridge, sir, and consult the manufacturer of your bridge if it doesn't work. Because otherwise, you know, all your support staff are tied up trying to do this kind of thing. In the long run, but not now, we'd like to be able to interrogate these things remotely over the net, but we can't do that yet. It's more things we would have liked to have done, but you know, don't stand a chance, frankly, if we want to get it to market. So they're on the bottom because we think they're better horizontal, because HDMI, for all its great virtues, falls out. Yeah. Wonderful. That way there's a chance it'll hit the back of the screen. There's an inside shot. The back is, as you can see, at the bottom. And you can see how the boards are stacked. There's one more board on the left, which is the basic power regulator board that goes half the depth of the product. Some of these boards go back a third to the bar, some go back rather further. And then the front half of it is basically filled with power amplifiers. There's three channels on the top and four on another board mated into it underneath. I've got one in the car, but we didn't bring it up. If somebody's keen, we'll bring it up at the end. And an output board just to get the signal out. It's probably as cheap to put it on a board as it is to wire it and work out what to do. So it makes a very testable system. If you take the bar off and humongous numbers of screws out the back panel, but with a power screwdriver it's not too bad, you can pull the cards out and you can put extenders in for service and examination, and particularly in development, that's rather useful. And actually, with a few more screws, you can release the power amp module and turn it kind of through 90 degrees so it sits on its heat sinks up in the air and it'll still run. So you have a finite chance of fixing one should they go wrong, and I'm glad to say they don't seem to, because that's the bit I spent my time on. But should they fail, you have a chance of fixing them. And I have been inside and looked at Japanese units, and basically it's like taking the gearbox and clutch out of a modern car. You know, you have to dismantle the whole thing to get there. So they lose a power transistor, which can happen, and it's a big, big job. That is how many layers?
Six.
We did it on six, very good. That is the processor board with those HDMI sockets along on it, and it runs along the bottom of the amplifier underneath it. I'm going to heave this thing up. It's bloody heavy, and you can get to it through there. And the reason for doing that is that backing onto that, the two big white sockets you can see running up at about 11 o'clock, is a baseboard, a motherboard if you will, but basically it's a backplane turned flat. And it has no electronics on, but lots of connectors and lots of screen. And it helps keep the junk that's clearly running at that thing running at some huge speed, lots of RAM, the whole thing, you know, half a gig of RAM or something. Yeah. It keeps that thing sort of out of the audio. It certainly helps. So, that's a very complex board, and both sides of it are covered in bits. but, you know, God forbid, and we will have to do it when we have to come to, you know, migrate the design in some way or another. In principle, we can change that board and work on it rather than having to tear up the whole design. You know, that's the theory. We shall see. That's the audio DSP board with Mrs. Analog Devices, two chips on it rather than one, but it works. And you can see the plugs, how it makes down on the bottom. So again, if there's problems, we can do it. There's my bit, and I said it's Class G design. Nobody has a pointer, I suppose. Nobody has a pointer. I don't have a pointer either. The white things towards the heat sink at the top left. Then there's a row of parts bolted to it, and from the left there are two rectifiers, because this has two power supplies. has a 30-volt supply and a 60-volt supply, crudely speaking, because it runs on two supplies, and unless the signal's bigger than the and needs to swing half supply voltage, you don't use the other one, and that's why it's efficient. I do have a little bit on this afterwards, but only if we have time. Then there are three pairs of output transistors, big fat, on semiconductor ones with thermal sensing, which means they track, you know what the junction temperature is instantaneously, which is very useful and I think matters in power amplifiers, so the bias doesn't drift. And the two devices to the left are 300-watt MOSFETs, which are used as the lifters. And in this design, because we A, don't have any space, and B, I had a budget, which I seriously exceeded, $75 for seven channels, without the heat sinks and PCBs. I always said that bit, you know, believe me. but, you know, a pair of devices shared between three channels, and provided you do the maths right and it's playing music, that works. No, don't overheat. In front of them, we're using, rather than the usual discrete parts to do the front end of a power amp, we A, didn't have much room. As you can see, they were constrained for space. And secondly, if you wanted a power supply rejection across multiple channels, you need lots of fat capacitors and so forth. I chose a new IC from National. I've been working with them on it for a couple of years, which swings 75 volts either way, has 100 dBs of power supply rejection, 0.301% distortion, etc., etc. And you can do some neat stuff with it. And we've used those, four of them, three stereos and one with one channel only used for the centre, to drive the system at the front end. That also has control of offsets, and there's little balanced line amplifiers in front of it. The interface from the rest of the circuit is fed sort of pseudo-balanced so that we can try to keep the interference and junk under control. And the last point, and it's not at all obvious from looking, and the little silver things are the driver heat sinks, by the way. The last point that's not at all obvious is that actually up to about 10 watts, this runs in class A. But it runs on low bias current. Now, of course, that is a definition, there are various definitions of class A depending where you come from. But in this instance, both transistors continue to be turned on to some degree up to that level. And if you do it right, you can largely make the circuit balance and largely take out the crossover distortion. And you have to read all those AES papers from the 80s. They're all out of patent. Still takes quite a lot of